and his friend until they clambered back down to safety. About a year after the false curfew, Michael's father began to lose a great deal of weight. Eventually, Arthur grew so weak and shaky that he could no longer hold a cup of tea. When he finally went to see a doctor for tests, it emerged that he had lung cancer. The living room became his bedroom, and Michael would hear him at night moaning in pain. He died at home on the 3rd of January, 1972. As Michael watched his father's casket being lowered into the frigid ground, he thought to himself that things could not possibly get any worse. 4. An Underground Army. Dolores Price was walking through Belfast with her mother, Chrissy, one day in 1971 when they rounded a corner and saw a British Army checkpoint. Pedestrians were being questioned and searched. Chrissy slowed her pace and murmured, "Are you carrying anything?" "No," Dolores said. "Are you carrying anything?" Chrissy asked again, more forcefully. In the distance, Dolores could see young men being thrown up against armored vehicles and ordered by the soldiers to take off their jackets. "Give it to me," Chrissy said. Dolores produced the pistol she had been carrying and discreetly handed it to her mother, who concealed it under her own coat. When they reached the checkpoint, Dolores was forced to take off her jacket, while Chrissy, being older, was waved through. Back at the house on Slievgallion Drive, Chrissy meticulously cleaned the gun, oiling each metal component. Then she wrapped it in some socks and buried it in the garden. Later, a quartermaster from the IRA stopped by to exhume the weapon. "Would your ma join?" he asked Dolores, only half in jest. "She's terrific at storing weapons." The Falls Road and the Shankill Road run roughly parallel as they move into the centre of Belfast, drawing closer together but never touching. The Falls Road was a stronghold for Catholics and the Shankill for Protestants, and these two arteries were connected by a series of narrow cross streets that ran between them at right angles and featured rows of identical terraced houses. At some point along each of these connecting streets, Catholic territory ended and Protestant territory began. During the riots of 1969, barricades went up around the neighbourhoods, formalising the sectarian geography. These would eventually be replaced by so-called peace walls, towering barriers that separated one community from another. Paramilitaries took to policing their respective enclaves, and teenage sentries manned the border lines. When the troubles ignited, the IRA was practically defunct. The group had engaged in a failed campaign along the border during the 1950s and early 60s, but the effort drew little support from the community. By the late 60s, some members of the IRA's leadership in Dublin had begun to question the utility of the gun in Irish politics, and to adopt a more avowedly Marxist philosophy which advocated peaceful resistance through politics. The organisation dwindled to such a degree that when the riots broke out in the summer of 1969, there were only about 100 IRA members in Belfast. Many of them, like Dolores's father Albert Price, were seasoned veterans of earlier campaigns but were getting on in years. For an army, they were also conspicuously unarmed. In a surpassingly ill-timed decision, the IRA had actually sold off some of its remaining weapons in 1968 to the Free Wales Army. There was still some residual expertise in how to manufacture crude explosives, but the IRA had developed a reputation as an outfit whose bombers had a tendency to blow themselves up more often than their targets. Traditionally, the Catholic minority in Northern Ireland had turned to the IRA for protection during periods of sectarian strife. But when the clashes started in 1969, the organisation could do little to stop jeering loyalists from burning Catholic families out of their homes. In the aftermath of these purges, some people began to suggest that what IRA really stood for was I Ran Away. There was a faction in Belfast that wanted to take a more aggressive stand, to rekindle the IRA's identity as an agent of violent change. In September 1969, an IRA commander named Liam McMillan held a meeting of the leadership in a room on Cypress Street. McMillan was widely blamed for the organization's failure to protect the community during the riots. 21 armed men burst into the meeting, led by Billy McKee, a legendary IRA street fighter. Born in 1921, months after the partition of Ireland, McKee had joined the youth wing of the IRA when he was only 15. He had spent time behind bars in every decade since. A devout Catholic who attended Mass every day and carried a gun with him at all times, he had pale blue eyes and the conviction of a zealot. "You are a Dublin communist and we are voting you out," he growled at McMillan. "You are no longer our leader." One of Albert Price's old friends, the writer Brendan Behan, famously remarked that in any meeting of Irish Republicans, the first item on the agenda is the split. To Dolores, a split in the IRA came to seem inevitable. By early 1970, a breakaway organization had formed, known as the Provisional IRA. They were explicitly geared to armed resistance. The old IRA had become known as the Official IRA. On the streets of Belfast, they were often distinguished as the Provos and the Stickies, because officials would supposedly wear commemorative Easter lilies stuck onto their shirt fronts with adhesive, whereas the more dyed-in-the-wool Provos wore paper lilies affixed with a pin. In 1971, 44 British soldiers were murdered by paramilitaries. But even as the two wings of the IRA intensified their battle with loyalist mobs, the RUC and the British Army, they now began to wage bloody war against each other. Andersonstown, where Dolores Price grew up, sits above the Falls Road, at the foot of the flat-topped Black Mountain, which looms over the city in the distance. As the situation grew dire in 1969, normal life had been suspended. Children could no longer safely walk to school, so many stopped going. Two of Dolores's aunts moved to the neighborhood after getting burnt out of their homes in other areas. The army frequently raided Andersonstown in search of IRA suspects or their weapons. One local house doubled as a bomb school, a clandestine explosives factory where provisional IRA recruits could learn how to rig up devices and handle incendiary material. Local residents resented incursions by the authorities, and the presence of armed and uniformed representatives of the British Crown only reinforced the impression that Belfast had become an occupied city. This dynamic of wartime siege led whole neighbourhoods to pull together and collaborate in opposition. "The local people had suddenly changed," Dolores Price later recalled. "They'd become Republicans." When the authorities were coming, housewives and little children would dash out of their homes, tear the metal lids off their dustbins, kneel down on the pavement, and crash the lids like cymbals against the paving stones, sending up a great gnashing din that reverberated through the back alleys, alerting the rebels that a raid was underway. Scrappy school-age kids would lounge on rubble-strewn street corners and unleash a piercing finger whistle at the first sign of trouble. It was an invigorating solidarity. As the violence intensified, grandiose funerals became routine, with rousing graveside orations and caskets draped in tricolour flags. People took to joking that there was no social life in Belfast anymore, apart from wakes. These ceremonies, with their pageantry of death and nationalism, held a certain allure for Dolores Price. She had returned to school after the march at Burntollet Bridge. For years, she had aspired to go to art school, but after applying, she was bitterly disappointed to learn that she had not been accepted. Instead, she secured a place at St. Mary's Teacher Training College, at the foot of the Falls Road, to earn a bachelor's degree in education. Albert Price was an intermittent presence in these years because he was involved in the new struggle. When the IRA needed guns, Albert went out looking for them. In the evening, Dolores would find groups of men huddled in her front room, scheming in low tones with her father. At a certain point, Albert went on the run, hiding out across the border in the Republic. Dolores started at St. Mary's in 1970. She was naturally smart and inquisitive and applied herself to her degree. But something had changed in her after the ambush at Burntollet Bridge. Both Dolores and Marion had been altered by that experience, their father would later say. After they got back to Belfast, they were never the same. One day, in 1971, Dolores approached a local IRA commander and said, "I want to join." The formal induction took place in the front room of the Price home on Slevgallion Drive. Someone said casually, "Hey, come in here a minute," and Dolores went in and raised her right hand and recited a declaration of allegiance. "I, Dolores Price, promise that I will promote the objectives of the IRA to the best of my knowledge and ability." She vowed to obey any and all orders issued to her by a superior officer, even as Dolores partook in this momentous rite. Her mother sat in the next room, nursing a cup of tea and behaving as though she had no inkling of what was going on. Since the moment she locked eyes with the loyalist who beat her at Burntollet Bridge, Dolores had concluded that her fantasy of peaceful resistance had been naive. "I'm never going to convert these people," she thought. No amount of marching up and down the road would bring the change that Ireland needed. Having strayed, in her youth, from the bedrock convictions upon which her family had built its legacy, she would come to regard the moment when she joined the IRA as a return, a sort of homecoming. Marion joined the Provost too. During the day, the sisters continued to attend school, but at night they would disappear, not returning to the house until late. In such situations, parents in West Belfast tended not to ask questions. Young people could vanish for a week at a time, and when they got home, nobody would inquire about where they had been. There was a reason for this. Because the IRA was a banned organisation, and even admitting to being a member was grounds for arrest, the group was fanatical about secrecy. Youths who joined the IRA tended not to tell their parents about it. In some cases, parents might disapprove. Belfast was dangerous enough already. To sign on as a paramilitary was simply tempting fate. Occasionally, a young IRA gunman would go out on a sniper mission, only to round a corner and bump smack into his own mother. Unfazed by the assault rifle in his hands, she would drag him home by the ear. But even if your parents were ardent supporters of the IRA, there were reasons not to tell them that you had joined. If the police or army broke down the door to interrogate them, the less they knew, the better. One of Dolores' friends was a big, square-jawed boy named Francie McGuigan. Like the Prices, the McGuigans were a staunch Republican family, and because their parents were friends, Dolores and Francie had known each other all their lives. When Francie joined the IRA, he knew that his father was a member as well, yet they never discussed it. This could be comical at times, with the two of them living under the same roof. Francie's father was a quartermaster in charge of weapons and ammunition, but when Francie needed bullets, he wouldn't ask his father. He would ask his friend Kevin instead. "Kevin, does my father have any rounds?" Kevin would ask Francie's father, who would give the rounds to Kevin, who would give them to Francie. It may not have been the most efficient way of doing business, but it meant that certain things could be left unsaid. The chief of staff of the Provost was a man named Sean McStephen, a moon-faced teetotaler in his early 40s, with a Cockney accent and a dimple in his chin. He'd been born John Stevenson in East London, and was raised by a mother who told him stories about her Irish upbringing in Belfast. After serving in the Royal Air Force, he had learned the Irish language, married an Irish girl, adopted an Irish name, and joined the IRA. It would later emerge that McStephen was not Irish at all. His mother, who was given to storytelling, had been born not in Belfast, but in Bethnal Green in London. But sometimes it's the myths that we believe most fervently of all. Some of McStephen's IRA colleagues, when they wanted to get a raise out of him, would forget to use his Irish name and call him John Stevenson. McStephen, though born a Protestant, was a devout Catholic who had done prison time in England for taking part in an IRA raid on an armory in 1953. He was a physical force Republican, an unwavering advocate of armed struggle as the only means of ousting the British. He once summarized his personal military strategy with three words: escalate, escalate, escalate. McStephen's embrace of violence was such that he became known to some of his contemporaries as Mac the Knife. In a passage in his 1975 memoir, McStephen recalled how Dolores Price approached him. She was planning a teaching career, he wrote, and though she came from a Republican family, she had been convinced until then that non-violent protest would succeed in overcoming the injustice in the North. He pinpointed the ambush at Burntollet Bridge as the moment that changed her mind. Initially, McStephen proposed that Dolores join the Connemann, the female auxiliary wing of the IRA. This was the same unit in which Chrissy Price and Auntie Bridie and Granny Dolan had all served. The women of the common did serious jobs. They would care for injured men or take a gun, still piping hot from use, and spirit it away after a shooting. But Price was offended by McStephen's offer. Her feminism, in combination perhaps with a certain air of entitlement as the scion of a notable Republican family, meant that she had no intention of being relegated to a supporting role. "I wanted to fight, not make tea or roll bandages," she later recalled. "Army or nothing." Price insisted that she was equal to any man, and she wanted to do exactly the same work that a man would do. What she wanted, she told Max Steffen, was to be a fighting soldier. A special meeting of the Provisional's Army Council was convened, and it was determined that for the first time in history, women could join the organisation as full members. This is likely to have been driven in large measure by the ambition and unimpeachable Republican lineage of Dolores Price. But Price herself would speculate that another factor may have played a role. Because men were being locked up en masse by the authorities, the provost may have felt that they had little choice but to start admitting women. If Price thought that being female, or coming from Republican royalty, or having an education that was fancy by the standards of the IRA, might win her any breaks, she was quickly disabused of such notions. After her swearing-in, she was summoned by her commanding officer to a house in West Belfast where several IRA men had gathered. There, Price was presented with a heap of filthy, mismatched, rusty bullets that had been dug up from some arms dump God knows where. Then somebody handed her a clump of steel wool and said, "Clean the bullets." This, Price decided with a sniff, was the most menial job imaginable. Any adolescent lad could do it. Was this really necessary? Come to think of it, were these bullets even functional? Was anybody ever actually going to shoot them? She pictured the IRA man sitting in the kitchen, chortling over the spectacle of her debasement. She was tempted to march in and say, "You know what you can do with these bullets," but she stopped herself. She had vowed to obey orders. All orders. This might be an initiation ritual, but it was also a test. So Price took the steel wool and started scrubbing. "You'd spent your life being taught that this was a glorious way of life," Price recalled. But if she was well acquainted with the romance of her new vocation, she was also aware of the risks. The IRA had just embarked on a shooting war with the British, and whatever her fellow recruits might say about their chances, the odds of success looked slim. In the likely event that you were outwitted or outgunned in any given operation, or in the whole campaign, you could expect the same fate as Porrick Pierce and the heroes of the Easter Rising. The British would end your life, then the Irish would tell stories about you forevermore. New recruits to the provost were told to anticipate one of two certain outcomes. Either you're going to jail or you're going to die. Chrissy Price knew the risks too, and for all her devotion to the cause, She worried about her daughter. "Would you not finish your education?" she implored. "Like the revolution's going to wait until I finish my education," Dolores replied. Most nights, when Dolores came home from operations, Chrissy would silently take her clothes and put them in the washer without asking any questions. But on one occasion, Dolores returned late at night to find her mother crying, because news had reached Chrissy of a bomb going off somewhere, and she had been seized by a fear that it might have killed her daughter. Not long after the Price sisters joined the Provost, they were sent across the border to attend an IRA training camp in the Republic. These camps were a ritualized affair. Recruits would be driven in a car or minibus along winding country roads to a remote location, usually a farm, where a local guide might appear, a housewife in her apron, or a sympathetic parish priest, and escort them to a farmhouse. The camps could last from a few days to more than a week, and they involved intensive training in revolvers, rifles, and explosives. The provos were still working with a limited arsenal of antiquated weapons, many of them dating back to the Second World War, but recruits learned to oil and disassemble a rifle and how to set a charge and prime explosives. They marched in formation, just as they might have done in basic training if they were serving in a conventional army. There was even a uniform of a sort. Day to day, the young rebels wore standard civilian garb of jeans and woolly sweaters, but during funerals they dressed in dark suits, sunglasses, and black berets, and stood in cordons along the pavements like a resolute, disciplined street army. The authorities could take photographs at such events, and frequently did, but their intelligence on this new crop of paramilitaries was still rudimentary, and they often could not match the faces of these young recruits to names or any other identifying information. If the image of an IRA man in Belfast during the 1960s entailed a gin-blossomed barstool radical, a shambling has-been full of tales about the old days, the provisionals set out to upend this caricature. They aimed to be clean, disciplined, organized, ideological, and ruthless. They called themselves Volunteers, a name that harked back to the doomed heroes of the Easter Rising and captured the sense that patriotism is a transaction in which the patriot must be prepared to pay dearly. As a volunteer, you stood ready to sacrifice everything, even your own life, in service to the cause. This pact tended to inculcate, among the revolutionaries, an intoxicating sense of camaraderie and mission, a bond that could seem indestructible. The Price sisters may have wanted to serve as frontline soldiers, but initially they worked as couriers. This was an important job, because there was always money or munitions or volunteers to ferry from one place to another, and moving from place to place could be risky. Dolores had a friend, Hugh Feeney, who owned a car, which she would sometimes use to make runs. The bespectacled son of a pub owner, Feeney was a middle-class boy who, like Dolores, had been a member of People's Democracy and was training to be a teacher when he fell in with the IRA. Even after becoming active volunteers, Dolores and Marion remained in college. This served as an excellent cover. They would come home after their classes, put away their books, and head out on operations. As women, the Price sisters were less likely than their male counterparts to attract attention from the authorities. Dolores would often cross the border several times a day, flashing a fake license that said her name was Rosie. She crossed so frequently that the soldiers manning the border checkpoints came to recognize her. They never grew suspicious, instead assuming that she must hold some dull job near the border that required her to cross back and forth. Dolores had a chatty, ingratiating, slightly flirtatious manner. People liked her. "Rosie," the soldiers would say when they saw her coming, "how are you today?" Often the Price sisters transported incendiary material. They came to know the scent of nitrobenzene, an ingredient of improvised explosives. It smelled like marzipan. Bomb-making materials were often prepared in the Republic and then smuggled north across the border. On one occasion, Marion was driving a car packed with explosives when she spotted an army checkpoint. She was still a teenager and was driving without a license. The explosives were concealed behind a panel in the driver's side door. As a soldier approached to inspect the car, he reached for the door handle, and Marion realized that if he opened it, he would instantly register the weight of the hidden payload. "I can manage," she said, hastily opening the door herself. She stepped out and stretched her legs. Mini skirts were all the rage in Belfast, and Marion happened to be wearing one, the soldier noticed. "I think he was more interested in looking at my legs than he was with the car," Marion said later. The soldier waved her through. There were some in the more starchy and traditional Cumnaman to whom the presence of women in such operational roles, women who might deploy their own sexuality as a weapon, was threatening, even mildly scandalous. Some common veterans referred to these frontline IRA women as army girls and insinuated that they were promiscuous. As tactics evolved in the conflict, IRA women occasionally set so-called honey traps, trolling bars in the city for unsuspecting British soldiers, then luring them into an ambush. One afternoon in 1971, three off-duty Scottish soldiers were out drinking in central Belfast when they were approached by a couple of girls who invited them to a party. The bodies of the soldiers were later discovered at the edge of a lonely road outside the town. It appeared that on the way to the party, they had stopped to urinate and somebody had shot all three of them in the head. The Price sisters disdained such operations. Dolores made a point of asking that she never be assigned to a honey trap. There were laws of war, she maintained. Soldiers should be shot in their uniforms. The spectacle of women as avatars of radical violence may have felt bracingly novel, but in other parts of the world, such figures were finding a place in the iconography of revolution. While Belfast was burning in the summer of 1969, a 25-year-old Palestinian terrorist named Leila Khaled hijacked a TWA flight from Rome to Tel Aviv and, with it, the attention of the world. Khaled diverted the flight to Damascus, becoming the first woman to hijack a plane. She emerged as a kind of pin-up for the new militancy. Her photo was splashed across glossy magazines, her dark eyes and cut-glass cheekbones framed by a keffiyeh, an assault rifle clutched in her hands. A few years later, a famous photo captured the American heiress Patty Hearst brandishing a sawn-off carbine and wearing a beret. One close friend of Dolores Price's suggested that at least part of the allure for her in those years was rebel chic. Stories about the Price sisters began to circulate among British troops stationed in Belfast and to find their way into the accounts of visiting war correspondents. They developed an outsized reputation as deadly femme fatales who would venture into the mean streets of Belfast with an assault rifle hidden down a bell-bottom trouser leg. Marion was said to be an expert sniper and was referred to, among British squaddies, as the Widowmaker. Dolores would become known in the press as one of the most dangerous young women in Ulster. It is hard to judge how seriously to take such folklore. Some of it was the kind of frisky, sexualized rumor that occasionally circulates in times of violent upheaval. A society that had always been a bit fusty and repressed was suddenly splitting apart in the most cataclysmic fashion. The perceived threats of sexual liberation and paramilitary chaos converged in the mythical specter of a pair of leggy, rifle-toting libertines. But if this image was to some degree a battlefield fantasy, one of the key people projecting it was Dolores Price herself. "Would you like to be shown round our bomb factory?" she asked a visiting reporter in 1972, adding, "We had Paris Match magazine taking pictures of the place last week." Eamon McCann, the activist from Derry who befriended Price on the Burntollet March, would still see her from time to time. She never told them explicitly that she had joined the Provos, but McCann knew. He was dismayed. He desperately wanted revolutionary change in Ireland, but he was certain that violence was not the way to achieve it. He told his friends who joined the armed struggle, "Nothing is going to come out of this that is commensurate with the pain that you will put into it." when he saw Price, McCann was always struck by her sheer glamour. Most of the Republican women he had known growing up were stern and pious. If not the Virgin Mary, exactly, then the Virgin Mary with a gun. The Price sisters were something else altogether. Dolores always dressed elegantly, her hair and makeup impeccable. They were sassy girls, McCann recalled. They weren't cold-eyed dialecticians or fanatics on the surface. There was a smile about them. In those days, there was a discount shop in Belfast called Crazy Prices, and, inevitably, Dolores and Marion became known among their friends as the Crazy Prices. Once, officers from the Royal Ulster Constabulary barged into the house on Slievgallion Drive at 6 in the morning and announced that they were arresting Dolores as a suspected member of an illegal organisation. "She's not going out of here until she's had her breakfast," Christy said. The police, cowed by this small but formidable woman, agreed to wait, and Chrissy instructed her daughter to go and put on makeup. She was buying time so that Dolores could collect her wits. When Dolores was ready to go, Chrissy put on a fur coat, which she normally reserved for special occasions. "I'm going with her," she announced. For a moment, Dolores was embarrassed, thinking, "I'm in the IRA and my mother is coming with me to get arrested." But off they went. At Castlereagh Police Station, she was interrogated. She knew the rules, however, and she gave the police no information, repeating only, "I have nothing to say." Eventually, she was released without charges. It would be difficult to make a case against Dolores. After all, she was still a student, with good marks and an attendance record to show for it. Before they left the station, Chrissy paused to admire the mugshot that the police had taken of her daughter. "Can I keep that?" She deadpanned. "That's a nice one." As a fundraising initiative, the Provos took to robbing banks. Lots of banks. One day, in the summer of 1972, three fresh-faced nuns walked into a branch of the Allied Irish Bank in Belfast just as it was about to close. The nuns reached under their habits and came out with guns, then proceeded to hold up the place. It was the Price sisters, along with another female volunteer. A month after the original robbery, three women walked into the very same bank and robbed it again. The identity of the thieves was never ascertained, but it was tempting to wonder whether the sisters had not returned for seconds. On another occasion, Dolores hijacked a post office lorry because the IRA had received intelligence that it was transporting sacks of money. For all the horror unfolding around them, there was a sense of adventure for Dolores and her comrades, a fantasy that they were dashing outlaws in a society in which all order had broken down. When one of Dolores' close colleagues in the IRA, a man named James Brown, was taken from prison to a hospital in Antrim with a burst appendix, the Price sisters carried out an audacious rescue mission, raiding the hospital, disarming the policemen there, and springing Brown free. It was a small miracle that the sisters managed to evade apprehension by the army or the police. Perhaps their ability to play the part of demure Catholic schoolgirls whenever they were confronted was enough to divert suspicion. But the authorities were also simply overwhelmed by the level of violence during this period. The ranks of the Provos were filled with interesting characters. Dolores became friendly with an older man named Joe Linsky, who had grown up on Cavendish Street, off the Falls Road, and still lived with his parents and his sister as he neared his 40th birthday. Linsky had trained as a monk during the 1950s at an abbey in Portannon, taking a vow of silence and rising before dawn each morning to pray. But he ended up leaving the order and joining the IRA. Linsky was a bit of an overgrown child, having sat out his adolescence at the monastery. He was regarded as something of an oddball by the younger volunteers. They called him the Mad Monk. But he had kind eyes and a gentle manner, and Dolores grew very fond of him. Another person Price became associated with was a tall, angular young man named Jerry Adams. He was an ex-bartender from Ballymurphy, who had worked at the Duke of York, a low-ceilinged pub in the city centre that was popular with Labour leaders and journalists. Like Price, Adams came from a distinguished Republican family. One of his uncles had broken out of Derry jail with her father. Adams had got his start as an activist with a local committee that protested against the construction of Devis Flats. He never attended college, but he was a fearsome debater, smart and analytical, like Dolores. He had joined the IRA a few years before she did, and he was already rising quickly through the Belfast leadership. Price had been loosely acquainted with Adams since childhood. When they were both kids, she used to see him riding with his family on the same buses she did to Republican commemorations at Eton Tubber and Bowdenstown. But now he had reappeared as a firebrand. The first time she recognised him on the back of a lorry, addressing a crowd, she exclaimed, "Who does Jerry think he is standing up there?" Price found Adams intriguing and faintly ridiculous. He was a gawky fella with big black-rimmed glasses, she would recall, and he had a quiet, watchful charisma. Price was irrepressibly outgoing, but she found it difficult to get a conversation started with Adams. He carried himself with an aloof air of authority and referred to her affectionately as child, though he was only a couple of years older than she was. The day after Price sprang James Brown from the hospital, Adams expressed concern about her operational security. "It's said in the paper that the women were not wearing disguises," he murmured, adding reproachfully, "I hope that isn't true." Price assured him that the press account was inaccurate because the sisters had been decked out in blonde wigs, bright lipstick, and garish headscarves, like two hers at a hockey match. Adams took himself pretty seriously, Price thought, but she could laugh at anyone. For security, Adams did not sleep in his own home and would bed down instead in various billets, some of which were not homes at all, but local businesses. He had taken to sleeping, lately, at a West Belfast undertaker's. Price found that hilarious. She joked that he slept in a coffin. "It was an exciting time," she said later. "I should be ashamed to admit there was fun in it." But there was. She had only just turned 21. Another family might disapprove of what Dolores and Marion were doing, but to Albert and Chrissy Price, there was a sense in which the girls were simply taking up a household tradition, and while you could blame a man for hitting someone, you could not blame him for hitting back. The Provo Army was started by the people to set up barricades against the loyalist hordes, Albert explained at the time. "We beat them with stones at first, and they had guns. Our people had to go and get guns. Wouldn't they have been right stupid people to stand there? Our people got shotguns at first and then got better weapons. And then the British, who were supposed to protect us, came in and raided our homes. What way could you fight? So you went down and you blew them up. That was the only thing left. If they hadn't interfered with us, there probably would be no Provo Army today." When British troops were killed, Albert would freely acknowledge the humanity of each individual soldier. "But he is in uniform," he would point out. "He is the enemy. And the Irish people believe that this is war." He was against death, he insisted, but ultimately this was a question of means and ends. "If we get a united socialist Ireland," Albert Price concluded, "then maybe it will all have been worth it." As if to underline the futility of non-violent resistance, when Eamon McCann and a huge mass of peaceful protesters assembled in Derry one chilly Sunday afternoon in January 1972, British paratroopers opened fire on the crowd, killing 13 men and wounding 15 others. The soldiers subsequently claimed that they had come under fire and that they only shot protesters who were carrying weapons. Neither of these assertions turned out to be true. Bloody Sunday, as it would forever be known, was a galvanizing event for Irish republicanism. Dolores and Marion were in Dundalk when they heard reports of the massacre. The news filled them with an overpowering anger. In February, protesters set fire to the British Embassy in Dublin. In March, London suspended the hated Unionist Parliament in Northern Ireland and imposed direct rule from Westminster. That same month, Dolores Price travelled to Italy to speak in Milan to help spread the word about oppression of Catholics in Northern Ireland. She lectured about the ghetto system and the lack of civil rights. "If my political convictions had led me to take part in murder, I would confess without hesitation," she told an interviewer. Employing the sort of deliberately evasive syntactical construction that would become typical when people described their actions in the Troubles. "If I had been commanded to go to kill an enemy of my people, I would have obeyed without the slightest fear." In a photograph from her appearance there, Price posed like an outlaw, with a scarf pulled across her face. 5. St. Jude's Walk. The McConville family had two dogs, named Provo and Sticky. After Arthur passed away, his oldest son, Robert, might have stepped in to assume responsibility for the family, but in March 1972, when he was 17, Robert was interned on suspicion of being a member of the official IRA, the Stickies. Jean McConville, who had been delicate by temperament to begin with, fell into a heavy depression after her husband's death. She had sort of given up, her daughter Helen later recalled. Jean did not want to get out of bed and seemed to subsist on cigarettes and pills. Doctors in Belfast had taken to prescribing nerve tablets, sedatives and tranquilizers to their patients, many of whom found that they were either catatonically numb or crying uncontrollably, unable to get a handle on their emotions. Tranquilizer use was higher in Northern Ireland than anywhere else in the United Kingdom. In some later era, the condition would probably be described as post-traumatic stress, but one contemporary book called it the Belfast Syndrome, a malady that was said to result from living with constant terror, where the enemy is not easily identifiable and the violence is indiscriminate and arbitrary. Doctors found, paradoxically, that the people most prone to this type of anxiety were not the active combatants, who were out on the street and had a sense of agency, but the women and children stuck sheltering behind closed doors. At night, through the thin walls of their flat in Devis Flats, the McConville children could hear their mother crying. Increasingly, Jean became a recluse. Some weeks, she would leave the house only to buy groceries or to visit Robert in prison. It might have simply felt unsafe to venture out. There was a discomforting sense in Belfast that there was no place where you were truly secure. You would run inside to get away from a gun battle, only to run outside again for fear of a bomb. The army was patrolling Devis, and paramilitaries were dug in throughout the complex. The year 1972 marked the high point for violence during the entirety of the Troubles, the so-called bloodiest year, where nearly 500 people lost their lives. Jean made several attempts at suicide, according to her children, overdosing on pills on a number of occasions. Eventually, she was admitted to Purdiesburn, a local psychiatric hospital. Nights were especially eerie in Devis. People would turn out all their lights, so the whole vast edifice was swathed in darkness. To the McConville children, one night in particular would forever stand out. Jean had recently returned from hospital, and there was a protracted gun battle outside the door. Then the shooting stopped, and they heard a voice. "Help me." It was a man's voice, not local. "Please, God, I don't want to die." It was a soldier, a British soldier. "Help me," he cried. As her children watched, Jean McConville rose from the floor where they had been cowering and moved to the door. Peeking outside, she saw the soldier. He was wounded, lying in the gallery out in front. The children remember her re-entering the flat and retrieving a pillow, which she brought to the soldier. Then she comforted him, murmuring a prayer and cradling his head, before eventually creeping back into the flat. Archie, who with Robert in prison was the oldest child there, admonished his mother for intervening. "You're only asking for trouble," he said. "That was somebody's son," she replied. The McConvilles never saw the soldier again, and to this day the children cannot say what became of him. But when they left the flat the next morning, they found fresh graffiti daubed across their door. "Brit Lover." This was a poisonous allegation. In the febrile atmosphere of wartime Belfast, for a local woman to be seen consorting with a British soldier could be a dangerous thing. Some women who were suspected of such transgressions were subjected to an antique mode of ritual humiliation, tarring and feathering. A mob would accost such women, forcibly shave their heads, anoint them with warm and sticky black tar, then shower a pillowcase of dirty feathers over their heads and chain them by the neck to a lamppost, like a dog, so the whole community could observe the spectacle of their indignity. "Soldier lover," the mob would bray, "soldier's doll." In an environment where many married men were being locked up for long stretches, leaving their wives alone, and where cocky young British soldiers were patrolling the neighbourhoods, deep-seated fears of infidelity, both marital and ideological, took hold. Tarring and feathering became an official policy of the Provisional IRA, which the leadership publicly defended as a necessary protocol of social control. When the first few cases turned up at local hospitals, the befuddled medical personnel had to consult with the maintenance crews who took care of their buildings about the best method of removing black tar. It felt to Michael McConville as if he and his family were strangers in a strange land. Expelled from East Belfast for being too Catholic, they were outsiders in West Belfast for being too Protestant. After their home was marked with the graffiti, what few local friends they had no longer wanted anything to do with them. Everywhere they turned, they found themselves in an adversarial situation. Archie was badly beaten by a youth wing of the Provos and had his arm broken for refusing to join the organisation. Helen and a friend were harassed by a regiment of soldiers. Helen would later suggest that her mother may have further alienated the family from their neighbours by declining to take part in the chain, the hand-to-hand system for hiding weapons during police searches of the complex. Jean feared that if she was caught with a gun in the house, she might lose another child to prison. At a certain point, the family dogs Provo and Sticky vanished. Someone had shoved the animals down a rubbish chute where they died. Michael had asthma, and Jean worried that the gas heating in the flat was aggravating it. She requested a transfer, and the family was granted a new flat in another section of Devis Flats called St. Jude's Walk. They packed their belongings and made the short move into the new space. It was slightly larger than the previous one, but otherwise not much different. Christmas was coming, but the city was hardly festive. Many shops were boarded up and closed because they had been bombed. Jean McConville's only indulgence in those days was a regular excursion to play bingo at the local social club. Whenever she won anything, she would give the children 20 pence each. Occasionally, she would bring home enough to buy one of them a new pair of shoes. One night after the family had moved into the new flat, Jean went with a friend to play bingo. But on that particular evening, she did not come home. Shortly after 2 a.m., there was a knock at the door. It was a British soldier who informed the McConville kids that their mother was at a barracks nearby. Helen raced to the barracks and found Jean, bedraggled and shoeless, her hair all over the place. Jean said that she had been at the bingo hall when someone came in and told her that one of her children had been hit by a car and that someone was waiting outside to take her to the hospital. Alarmed, she left the bingo hall and got into the car. But it was a trap. When the door opened, Jean was pushed onto the floor and a hood was placed over her head. She was taken to a derelict building, she said, where she was tied to a chair, beaten and interrogated. After she was released, some army officers found her wandering the streets, distressed, and brought her to the barracks. Jean couldn't or wouldn't say who it was that had abducted her. When Helen wondered what kinds of questions they had been asking, Jean was dismissive. "A load of nonsense," she said. "Stuff I knew nothing about." Jean could not sleep that night. Instead, she sat up, her face bruised, her eyes black and blue, and lit one cigarette after another. She told Helen that she missed Arthur. The children would later recall that it was the following evening that Jean sent Helen out to fetch fish and chips for dinner. She filled a bath to try and soothe the pain of the beating she had taken the night before. As Helen was leaving, she said, "Don't be stopping for a sneaky smoke." Helen made her way through the labyrinthine passages of Divis to the local takeaway where she ordered dinner and waited for it. When the food was ready, she paid, took the greasy bag and started to walk back. As she entered the complex, she noticed something strange. People were loitering on their balconies outside their flats. This was the sort of thing that local residents did in the summertime. There were so few places for recreation in Divis that kids would play ball on the balconies and parents would hang about on temperate evenings, leaning in the doorways, gossiping over cigarettes. But not in December. As Helen got closer to the new flat and saw the people gathered outside, she broke into a run. 6. The Dirty Dozen. A vacant house stood on Leeson Street, opposite the short block known as Varna Gap. Such derelict properties pockmarked Belfast's landscape. Burnt out, gutted or abandoned, their windows and doors covered in plywood. The people who lived there had simply fled and never come back. Across the street from the vacant house, Brendan Hughes stood with a few of his associates from D Company. It was a Saturday, 2nd of September, 1972. Looking up, Hughes noticed a green van appear some distance away and began to approach along Leeson Street. He watched the van closely, something about it making him uneasy. He usually carried a handgun, but that morning an associate had borrowed it so that he could use it to steal a car, so Hughes found himself unarmed. The van drove right past him, close enough for Hughes to briefly glimpse the driver. It was a man, not one he recognized. He looked nervous. But the van kept moving right down on through McDonald Street and onto the Grosvenor Road. Hughes watched it disappear. Then, just to be on the safe side, he sent one of his runners to fetch a weapon. At 24, Hughes was small but strong and nimble, with thick black eyebrows and a mop of unruly black hair. He was the officer commanding the OC for D Company of the Provisional IRA, in charge of this part of West Belfast, which made him a target not just for loyalist paramilitaries, the police and the British Army, but for the Stickies, the official IRA as well. 18 months earlier, Hugh's cousin Charlie, his predecessor as OC of D Company, had been shot and killed by the officials. So Hughes was on the run in the parlance of the IRA. He was living underground, a man targeted by multiple armed organizations. In rural areas, you could stay on the run for years at a time, but in Belfast, where everybody knew everybody, you would be lucky to stick it out for 6 months. Someone would get you eventually. Hughes had joined the Provos in early 1970. It was through his cousin Charlie that he had initially got involved, but he soon established himself in his own right as a shrewd and tenacious soldier. Hughes moved from house to house, seldom sleeping in the same bed on consecutive nights. D Company's territory embraced the Grosvenor Road, the Old Pound Loney area, the Falls Road, the hottest territory in the conflict. Initially, the company had only 12 members, and they became known as the Dogs, with a dirty dozen. Hughes adhered to a philosophy, instilled in him at a young age by his father, that if you want to get people to do something for you, you do it with them. So he wasn't just sending men on operations, he went along on the missions himself. Dolores Price first met Hughes when she joined the IRA, and she was dazzled by him. He seemed to be 100 places at the one time, she recalled, adding, I don't think he slept. Despite his small stature, Hughes struck Price as a giant of a man. It meant something to her, and to others, that he asked no volunteer to do anything he would not do himself. D Company was carrying out a dizzying number of operations, often as many as 4 or 5 each day. He would rob a bank in the morning, do a float in the afternoon, prowling the streets in a car, casting around like urban hunters for a British soldier to shoot, stick a bomb in a booby trap before supper, then take part in a gun battle or two that night. They were heady, breakneck days, and Hughes lived from operation to operation, robbing banks, robbing post offices, holding up trains, planting bombs, shooting at soldiers. To Hughes, it seemed like a grand adventure. He thought of going out and getting into gunfights the way other people thought about getting up and going to the office. He liked the fact that there was a momentum to the operations, a relentless tempo which fueled and perpetuated the armed struggle because each successful operation drew new followers to the cause. In the words of one of Hughes's contemporaries in the IRA, good operations are the best recruiting sergeant. As the legend of Brendan Hughes, the young guerrilla commander, took hold around Belfast, the British became determined to capture him. But there was a problem. They did not know what he looked like. Hughes's father had destroyed every family photograph in which he appeared, knowing that they would be used to identify him. The soldiers referred to him as Darky, or the Dark, on account of his complexion, and the name stuck, a battlefield sobriquet. But the British did not know what his face looked like, and on many an occasion, Hughes had walked right past the soldier sandbagged posts. Just another shaggy-haired Belfast lad. They didn't give him a second look. The soldiers would go to his father's house and rouse him from bed, looking for Hughes. Once, when they hauled his father in for questioning, Hughes was incensed to learn that after 2 days of interrogation, the old man had been forced to walk home barefoot. The soldiers told his father that they weren't looking for Brendan in order to arrest him. Their intention was to kill him. This was not an idle threat. The previous April, an official IRA leader named Big Joe McCann had been walking unarmed one day when he was stopped by British troops. He tried to flee, but was shot. McCann had dyed his hair as a disguise, but they recognized him. He was only wounded by the initial shots, and he staggered away. But rather than call an ambulance, the soldiers fired another volley to finish the job. When they searched his pockets, they found nothing that could plausibly be described as a weapon, just a few stray coins and a comb for his hair. The runner had not yet returned with a gun for Hughes when the van reappeared. 5 minutes had passed, yet here it was once more. Same van, same driver. Hughes tensed, but again the van drove right past him. It continued on for 20 yards or so. Then the brake lights flared. As Hughes watched, the back door swung open and several men burst out. They looked like civilians, tracksuits, trainers, but one had a .45 in each hand, and 2 others had rifles. As Hughes turned to run, all 3 of them opened fire. Bullets swished past him, slamming into the facades of the 4 lone houses as Hughes tore off and the men gave chase. He sprinted onto Cypress Street, the men pounding the pavement behind him, still firing, but now Hughes began to zigzag like a gecko into the warren of tiny streets. He knew these streets, the hidden alleys, the fences he could scale. He knew each vacant house and washing line. There was a quote attributed to Mao that Hughes was partial to, about how the guerrilla warrior must swim among the people as a fish swims through the sea. West Belfast was his sea. There was an informal system in place whereby local civilians would assist young paramilitaries like Hughes, allowing their homes to be used as shortcuts or hiding places. As Hughes was scrambling over a fence, a back door would suddenly pop open long enough for him to dart inside, then just as quickly close behind him. Some of the residents were intimidated by the provost and felt like they had little choice but to cooperate, while others assisted out of an unforced sense of solidarity. When property was damaged in one of Hughes's operation, he would pay compensation to the family. He cultivated the community, knowing that without the sea, the fish cannot survive. There was a local invalid who lived on Cypress Street, Squire Maguire, and at the height of the madness, with fires and police raids and riots in the street, residents in the area would occasionally see Brendan Hughes carrying Maguire on his back a few doors down to the pub so that Maguire could have a pint, then dutifully returning to bring him home a short while later. Once a British soldier in the Lower Falls area caught Hughes in the sights of his rifle. Finger on the trigger, he was ready to open fire when an elderly woman stepped out of some unseen doorway and planted herself in the path of his weapon, then informed him that he would not be shooting anybody on her street on that particular evening. When the soldier looked up, Hughes was gone. With his pursuer still clumping after him, firing wildly, Hughes veered onto Sultan Street. He had a specific destination in mind, a call house on Sultan Street. Call houses were usually regular homes, occupied by ordinary families that happened to double as clandestine provo facilities. Behind one particular door, on a street of identical brick houses with identical wooden doors, would be a secret refuge that could function as a safe house, a waiting room, or a dead drop. The families that lived in these homes deflected any suspicion from authorities. You might show up after midnight, haggard from a grueling day on the run, and they would lift slumbering children out of their beds, affording you a precious night of rest. At the corner of Sultan Street, a baker's van was delivering bread, and as Hughes ran by it, the men behind him let off a volley of bullets which punctured the van and shattered its windows. He kept pushing, sprinting the length of Sultan, desperate to reach the house before one of those bullets caught him. In addition to its other uses, a call house sometimes functioned as an arms depot. Hughes had become known to the British Army for his willingness to flit around the streets of the Falls area and engage their high-caliber weapons with his little World War II-era 45. The troops had developed what one later described as a grudging admiration for this little bugger who had taken on an elite military unit with a handgun. But Hughes recognized at a certain point that he needed heavier weapons if he was going to compete. One day, a sailor of his acquaintance came back from a voyage to America with a catalogue for the Armalite rifle, a lightweight, accurate, powerful semi-automatic that was easy to clean, easy to use, and easy to conceal. Hughes fell in love with the weapon. He convinced the provost to import the Armalite, employing an audacious scheme. Connard Lines had recently launched the Queen Elizabeth II, a luxury cruise liner that would crisscross the Atlantic, transporting well-heeled passengers between Southampton and New York. 1,000 crew members worked on the ship, many of them Irish. Some of them also happened to work for Brendan Hughes. In this manner, Hughes used a ship named after the British Queen to smuggle weapons to the IRA. When the guns arrived, fresh graffiti on the walls of West Belfast heralded a game change. God made the Catholics, but the Armalite made them equal. Hughes was tearing along so fast that he almost passed the call house, and when he staggered to a sudden stop and swung open the door, he had acquired so much momentum that he went crashing, instead, right through the front window. He tumbled into the front room, got his bearings, and retrieved an Armalite. Then he stepped outside, saw his pursuers barreling towards the house, trained the Armalite on them, and started shooting. The men scrambled for cover and fired back. Then, out of nowhere, two Saracen armored vehicles materialized, rumbling down the road. They stopped abruptly, and suddenly the men were gone. Hugh stood there, panting, processing what he had just witnessed. The gunmen had been dressed like civilians, but they had escaped in a British Army vehicle. They weren't civilians. They were British Army. That was when Hughes looked down and realized he was bleeding. Hughes had grown up surrounded by Protestants in a predominantly Protestant enclave of West Belfast. When he was a child during the 1950s, many of his friends were Protestant kids. There was an old woman who lived on the street who would spit every time he passed her house and ask if he had blessed himself with the Pope's piss that morning. But for the most part, he coexisted peacefully with the Protestants around him. Hughes was not yet 10 years old when his mother died of cancer, leaving his father, Kevin, a bricklayer, to care for 6 children alone. Kevin never remarried. 2 of Brendan's brothers emigrated to Australia in search of work, and he stepped up, helping his father raise his younger siblings. Kevin would go out to work, and Brendan would be in charge of the kids at home. His father described him, in a modest expression that still counted as the highest praise, as a lad you could depend on. In 1967, Hughes joined the British Merchant Navy and went to sea. He voyaged to the Middle East and to South Africa, where he witnessed up close the horrors of apartheid. By the time he returned 2 years later, Belfast had erupted into violence. Though he never spoke of it, Brendan's father had been a member of the IRA in his youth. One of Kevin's friends from that era was Billy McKee, the famous hard-lined paramilitary who had helped to establish the Provos, and Brendan was brought up to revere McKee as a legendary patriot and gunman. When the family walked to Mass on Sunday mornings, they would pass McKee's house on McDonald Street, and Brendan felt as though he should genuflect out of respect for the man. Once, in some scullery where tea was being made after a funeral, he spotted McKee in conversation with some other adults. Brendan deliberately pushed against him and felt the bracing hardness of the .45 under his belt. Unable to control his curiosity, Brendan asked McKee if he could see the weapon, and McKee showed it to him. When Brendan Hughes left to join the Merchant Navy, his father made a peculiar request. Never get a tattoo. It was common for sailors to tattoo their bodies, and Hughes would have found himself in various tattoo parlors across Europe and the Far East, waiting while his mates submitted to the needle. But he honored his father's request. Kevin never gave any specific rationale for the admonition, apart from suggesting, vaguely, that a tattoo was an identifiable mark. But years later, Brendan would reflect on that moment, wondering whether his father might have had some premonition about the road that he would end up taking. At the call house on Sultan Street, he was losing blood quickly, but not from a gunshot. When he crashed through the front window, the broken glass had severed an artery in his wrist. The call house was blown now. It would not be safe to remain there, so several colleagues hustled Hughes into another house a short distance away. He badly needed medical attention, but getting him to a hospital was out of the question. The army had sent men to execute him, and there was no policy of sanctuary that might protect him in a medical facility. The alternative was getting a doctor to come to Hughes, but that would pose a different sort of challenge. The men who tried to kill him had disappeared, but Saracens were still patrolling the neighborhood, no doubt searching for him. Hughes was trapped inside the house, like some wounded animal, the blood pumping out of his arm with each beat of his heart. Half an hour went by. Things were looking grim. Then Jerry Adams arrived with a doctor. Adams might have been the best friend that Brendan Hughes had. They had met 2 summers earlier, during the riots of 1970, when Adams was directing rioters. Hughes couldn't remember Adams himself actually throwing stones or petrol bombs, but he was very effective in orchestrating others. That was Adams' role in Hughes' view. He was a key strategist for the provost, whereas Hughes was more of a tactician. Fearless and cunning, Hughes could mastermind any operation, but Adams had the sort of mind that could perceive the broader political context and the shifting tectonics of the conflict. Like a general who stays behind the battle lines, Adams was known for avoiding direct violence himself. If a convoy of cars loaded with Armalites arrived in the neighborhood, Adams would ride in the scout car, the one without any weapons, whereas Hughes tended to be wherever the guns were. Dolores Price liked the joke that she never saw Hughes without a gun and she never saw Adams with one. To Adams, it seemed that Hughes was always very much in the thick of things. He had a tremendous following among the lads on the street, Adams later observed, adding that Hughes compensated for any inability to articulate politically at great length by doing the right things instinctively. If there was something faintly patronizing about this observation, it fitted, more or less, with the role Hughes saw for himself in the conflict. He regarded himself as a soldier, not a politician. He considered himself a socialist, but he wasn't consumed by ideology. He considered himself a Catholic too, but Adams said the rosary and read the Bible every night, whereas it was an effort for Hughes to get the Mass. Hughes sometimes remarked that his reverence for Adams was such that if Adams told him that tomorrow was Sunday, when he knew that it was Monday, it would be enough to make him stop and think twice. Brendan's own little brother, Terry, remarked that Brendan's real family was the IRA and his brother was Jerry Adams. The doctor whom Adams had summoned was a local heart surgeon, but because he had come in such a hurry, he had no equipment. So someone fetched a needle and thread and a pair of tweezers, and the surgeon plunged the tweezers into the wound in Hughes's arm, grasping blindly for the recessed end of the severed vessel. Securing it finally between the tweezers' prongs, he pulled the artery down so he could carefully sew it up. This rough procedure was conducted in close quarters, without anesthetic, but Hughes could not scream, because the army was still looking for him, patrolling the street outside. At one point, while the doctor was working, a Saracen pulled up right in front of the house and lingered there, its powerful engine rumbling, while they all waited, frozen, wondering if men with rifles were about to break through the door. That Adams had come personally meant a great deal to Hughes, because it was risky for him to do so. According to the special branch of the RUC, Adams had been commander of the Ballymurphy unit of the Provisionals and later became the officer commanding the Belfast Brigade, the top IRA man in the city. He was a marked man, more wanted by the authorities than even Hughes. But Adams felt a deep bond of loyalty to Hughes. In addition to the genuine affection they shared, it mattered to Adams that when Hughes went on the run, he remained on the streets of Belfast rather than